Hi, everybody. So today I'm going to talk a bit about understanding the dark side of the internet. So we've already heard a lot about different types of bad content that goes online, mainly in the form of defamatory things, illicit content, that sort of thing. Today, here's what I'm going to focus on. First, I'm going to talk a lot about phishing attacks, because that's where a lot of my research is focused. Talk about how these phishing attacks are run and the criminal organizations behind them. And then I'm going to talk about other types of fraudulent websites, these mule recruitment websites, online pharmacies, different types of things you may not have heard of. You probably have heard of phishing. And then I'm going to sort of compare these all and use this to kind of explain how there are sort of different incentives for removing all of this content, which we can measure the effect of. So, starting earlier in this decade, around 2003-ish, criminals figured out how to systematically exploit the internet to make money. And this is kind of represented a sea change. What they've learned is that they can exploit the good things about the internet, its openness, and the other things we've talked about in the class, and especially at scale, to carry out high-volume crime. And they've done this in a way that's exploited sort of shortcomings and gaps in international law and coordination between law enforcement. So we're going to talk about how some of these scams work and then talk about the countermeasures and see how effective they are. So the other thing I'm going to focus on is just comparing the effectiveness of these notice and takedown regimes. So most types of illicit content that you see on the internet is eventually removed by someone, not all of it. And we've already talked a lot in this class about how we have actual takedown regimes enshrined in the law for copyright infringement through DMCA takedown notices. The law's also weighed in on defamatory content through the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, where it allows ISPs to remove content at their discretion, but doesn't compel them to do so. As we'll see, for a lot of the other kinds of bad content, there really is no position in the law. And I'm going to talk about the average time required to remove all of this different bad content, because I've collected data on that, surprisingly, there are very big differences in the time it takes. And when you look at the incentives behind the people who are trying to remove the content, you can understand why some content takes longer to be removed than others. Right, so first I'll talk about phishing. Let me jump out of the presentation and give a couple examples.
Let's go to this one here. Seems to have changed under my feet.
All right, so we have a website here. It's for USAA, which is a military bank. It says, forgot your online ID, and you have to provide all your credentials, and then you can log in. This looks like a real banking website, but it's not. Can anyone tell me why it's not? Looking at the details of this page, is there any way you can tell that this is a legitimate versus an illegitimate site? Yeah, Vladimir? Okay, so that's one thing, right? So you look at the top in the URL bar, you'll see it says http:, not HTTPS. Okay, so that's an indicator, although sometimes, when you go to the main bank page, it's not always, you'll see an HTTP without an HTTPS. But by the time you get to a login page, yeah, you should see HTTPS. Yeah? Oh, right. Okay, so it's USAA.com, which we like, but after the .com is another dot. It's not a slash, right? So, yes, that's sort of the telltale sign. So these scams basically rely on you not knowing how to process the URL. You say, yeah?
I like how it says next to USAA that USAA.com is a secure site.
Yeah, well, it is. And they even got a padlock, right? Because the padlock means that it's secure, right? So, yeah. This basically looks perfect. And when you compare it to the real USAA.com, you go there. It seems to have okay. It must have figured out that I was on a phishing site. Okay, so we say, oh, I forgot my online ID, and this is what we see, and you see the same thing. USAA.com is a secure site, so they basically lifted the entire structure of the website. It asks for different things now. It asks for just the USAA number, but it also asks for your social security number, which is, I would tend to be wary of, right? You have a website asking for your social security number. In fact, the phishing scam kind of asks for even sort of less invasive things. It does ask for your online ID and your credit card number. So we have two different types of phishing sites, and these are live right now. You can go to these links, and you'll see them. Spencer?
So what was the .com explanation?
Let me explain this. Let's look at the good site. This is the real USAA.com. Two things. One, we see that in the top, it's HTTPS, so that means that there is a certificate which has been issued for USAA. You recall earlier in the course we talked about Diffie-Hellman for private and public key exchange. That's effectively what's going on behind the scenes here. But when you look at the URL itself, it says USAA.com, then it says slash INET, slash all this other stuff. So the way to read a URL is to see that the domain only stops when the dots stop, basically. So USAA.com is the domain, whereas if you look for the other one, it still says USAA.com, but then it says .mtrds10.com. So mtdrs.com is the actual domain. It's the furthest along the right. Because you can, this is just a quirk of how URLs work, is that You can say whatever you want to the left of the domain. The only thing that actually matters for resolving the domain is what you see on the far right hand side. Okay, does that make sense? Okay. So how did I find this? One way you can find it is you can go to this website called Fish Tank. So Fish Tank is a free service run by volunteers who've taken it upon themselves. They decided they don't like phishing, so they have created this website where anyone can come in, submit a phishing URL that they've discovered, and then it's voted on. And if once it gets voted on, it's validated, and then it gets sent out to your web browser blockers and this sort of thing. So if we click on, for instance, this one, you'll see that it has been verified as a fish, and you've got, they even tell you who's voted on it. So you have the handles for all the different people who have voted. So you have four people all saying it's a fish, and there you go, 100%, everyone said it's a fish. And so it gets into this filter. So I guess a couple of quick observations here. One is, look, we're already on submission 690,000. So Fish Tank's been around for about a little over 2 years, 2.5 years. And they've already gone through 700,000 phishing websites. So there's a lot of these things popping up all the time, literally thousands in a day. And you kind of have to wonder, what's motivating all this? How many people are creating all these sites? The next thing I would say is, it's a little. Well, tell me, what do you think? Do you think something like this is a good thing? What are the risks of having something like Fish Tank out there publishing all the phishing URLs on the web. Is it all good, or is there a risk here?
Yeah. Someone can submit something as a phish that isn't actually a phish and tarnish the reputation of a legitimate.
Right. So Fish Tank does. The way Fish Tank deals with that is they have this voting process, right, where everyone comes through and votes. And if you look, here's a list of all the things that have been voted down. Top of the list is a New York Times article that is about some banker being charged for insider trading. So this is clearly not a phishing website, but somebody nonetheless submitted it to Fish Tank. The voting system seemed to work. They recognized it. But it might be the case that some things slip through the cracks. Any other thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I mean, publishing the fish websites will spur creation of more of them just because they can check what's already like labeled as a phishing website and then create another one.
Okay, so you give an idea to the bad guys. They can see what the phishing site looks like, so they can copy it. Or
like they see that it's already recognized as a phishing site, and so it won't work. So they just create another one. So,
okay.
Kind of just spurs the creation of more of them.
Okay. Yeah. So that's possible. One question you might think is, could this, when you look at all of these sites, there's a lot of websites here, a lot of these are legitimate websites which have been compromised, right? So some attacker has discovered a vulnerability on these websites that allow them to upload a phishing page onto the site. And just listing all these domains, you might think, would allow an attacker to, hey, I can go compromise that site and put my own phishing page on there, you might think. But what's the pushback against that?
I mean, if these are sites that have been compromised, then they're like uncompromised. Then it's. I mean, right now they're up on a site that says that they're not legitimate, and that could really hurt the company or organization.
Right. So the reputation of svwriter.de might be harmed here because you know they're saying this is a bad site. That's true. So you have to balance against the harm that you can reduce by identifying as a phishing site, and then maybe the good that could come out of it is that svwriter.de will be notified that there's a phishing site, and then they'll actually take some action to clean it up. We actually looked at this and found that websites which were showed up in Fish Tank were slightly less likely to be recompromised again. Than other phishing sites, so it doesn't seem to be causing significant harm. The good of publishing this information out there seems to be outweighing the bad, although I think it's definitely a delicate balance.
Is there any legal problem with doing this? I mean, it's like citizen run for free and it's for a good cause, but is it controversial? I mean,
okay, right. So is legally is. They're definitely operating in a legal gray area, right? Because, they're doing good, but you know, they have good intentions, but they might make a mistake. They might characterize and slander a good domain. The other side, I would say, is in addition to the good that they do. Or in addition to the legal questions, it's also, you might ask yourself, why are volunteers doing this? Why isn't it the police, right? I mean, this is illegal, this is online fraud, and yet the police aren't doing this. This is a pure volunteer effort.
Well, the police just aren't trained well enough to do it. There are plenty of volunteers out there who know a lot more about it and are able to recognize it with much better expertise than the police would ever be able to.
Okay, yeah, so that's true, yeah. So, and what we see is that there are lots of private actors who have an interest in phishing, and we'll see that this actually means that phishing websites are removed very quickly compared to other types of illegal content. Okay, I'll go back to the presentation now. So, let's talk a little bit more in a bit more detail about phishing. So, yeah, how do you run a phishing scam? Well, first you have to send out lots and lots of phishing spam, right, which pretends to be from your bank and gives you a link to one of these websites that we just looked at. And there are different ways you can host a phishing scam. You can put it on a free web space provider like GeoCities, and some scammers do that. It's kind of a downside in that there's often advertising put on that site, so it sort of undermines the credibility of the impersonation. But a lot of attackers do it anyway. The more common thing is to just put it on a compromised machine. Like, you know, you have this website with some directory that has been compromised, and you put the bank in there. Now, this has its own downside in that, you know, anyone who sort of knows what they're doing and even looks at the URL will sort of see that this seems fishy. But you'd be surprised, this is the vast bulk of what you see. The people who fall for phishing are more likely to not really know how to deal and translate what a URL means in the first place. So in any event, you host your phishing website. Once you've actually got the hook and the details, you have a way of getting the customer information to the criminal, and they do this either by just really primitively forwarding onto a webmail account, like a Gmail account, or they might just store it in a text file on the website and then come back and visit it. So how do you defend against these kinds of attacks? There's all kinds of fancy technical countermeasures that people are putting in place. You have, whenever you try to visit a lot of phishing websites, your browser has a list of them, and it will come up with a big warning saying, this is a phishing site, don't go here. The other way they do it, which is what we've looked at more closely, is they just try to get the websites removed as quick as they can. So they collect these lists of phishing URLs, they put it in a blacklist, and then they send takedown requests to the ISP where it's located. And unlike a DMCA takedown notice, there is no force of law behind it. A DMCA takedown notice involves a court and involves a judge. A takedown request here consists of calling your contact at the ISP where the bad site is located and imploring with them to get their content removed. It operates pretty much completely outside the legal system. And the reason for this is not that phishing isn't illegal, because it is, but because what the banks have decided is what matters is to get the content removed quickly. And so that they find it much easier to just bypass the legal system entirely, especially because they're working across national boundaries, and that just slows things down even more if you were to work through law enforcement. So, when I showed you Fish Tank, there were 700,000 phishing websites. You might wonder how do you even discover these things? How could an attacker find out what a phishing web, you know, where a vulnerable website is? Well, the standard approach has been to use automated scanning techniques, you know, but what we're seeing attackers do more and more is to do what we do every day. They just use Google or other search engines to ask where the hosts are located. And if you can ask with a very targeted search, you can come up with lists and lists of vulnerable websites. And what we did is we managed to get a few thousand phishing websites with the usage logs. So from that, we could find out all the search terms that people were using to visit the site. And by looking through those logs, we saw a lot of these so-called evil search terms. So search terms like this: PHP Izabi v0.848b. Very, very targeted. And the reason why it's PHP Izabi version 0.848 is that because there is a known vulnerability in this piece of software, which allows you to upload any file you want onto a web server that's running this version of software. Okay, and so when we're going through this list, we saw a whole host of these. Often they'll look for existing phishing websites that have been compromised, because that's a good place where they could recompromise more sites. So they'll look for all entitled welcome PayPal. And then another way is through these specialized shell searches. I won't go into the details of those. But when you look at it, we found several hundred of these website of the phishing websites where we studied had phrases like this. And if we look at an example, for this one I talked about, PHP Izabi version 0.415b3. You look for that. A while ago when I ran the search, there were about 700 sites which had this turned up in it. One of these is this Dream Dates and Personals, some basically online chat dating site, but it happens to be running the vulnerable software. When we combined this back with our server logs, we found that, oh, lo and behold, there was a website, chattome247.com/all these directories, lloydstsb.co.uk. You've got a phishing scam on the site that turned up in our Google results. And then when we look at the search terms for this chat to me site and their logs, because we had their logs, one day later, this search term appears in the log. So it's direct evidence that the attacker actually did use this very search term. And then it turns out that somebody used it again to recompromise the site. Okay? So the first time this thing gets cleaned up, but all the person at Chat to Me 24/7 did was they just deleted this phishing scam from their server. They didn't do anything to address this underlying PHP Izabi vulnerability, right? And when we look more closely at this across all the whole sample, this pattern of getting a compromise, you find the search terms and it gets recompromised, is very strong. Any time the web server's logs had these evil search terms in them, it made them more than twice as likely to be recompromised and hosted for another phishing website later on. Right? So Google is being used here to Google and Yahoo and others are being used to discover websites to compromise. So what do you think about that? Is this just a cost of doing business through web search, or is this, you know, or should something be done? Should we be blocking PHP Izabi searches on Google? What do you think? Yeah.
Are the companies
So they're not required to. No, they could just remove that from the page.
It would be impossible to tell everyone, please.
Yeah. Well, this is the recurring problem, is it's impossible to tell everyone on the internet anything, okay, because there's always somebody who's not going to listen. But even if you did, it might do more harm than good, because the good guys use this as well. Because if you're running a web server, how are you going to know if you're running the latest vulnerable version? Well, you do a search through your logs and see if it's there. So that might, yeah, it's unclear whether you can do anything to stop this from happening. Any other thoughts? Okay. So let's move on here and let's talk about organized crime. So organized crime has gotten involved in the phishing realm as well. But they don't bother going and finding phishing websites to host. They operate a much more sophisticated scheme. They purchase domains because they've got money through selling credit cards or whatever. They purchase tens and hundreds of domains at a time with random-sounding names like lawfady.info. And then their phishing emails look a little different. They have www.banknamed.com, .so-on, and so on, filing to the domain, which is like the first phishing example I showed you at the beginning of class. You know, you see the bank name dot, and then more dots continuing on to the actual domain, tricking people's understanding of URLs. And then from there, they host the name servers, which then resolve to IP addresses for computers which are compromise themselves. But not compromise web servers, compromise PCs. Computers that everyone runs in their home, off Comcast, Harvard, all these places. And these compromised machines will end up proxying back to the ultimate server, which actually hosts the phishing content. And the server will be loaded with up to 20 phishing websites at a time. It's quite resilient because they can using just this one domain, loft80.info, they can just change the bank name here and then lead you to a different bank that they're attacking. So they've got this dynamic pool of domains that they're constantly registering. So as one gets caught and removed, they've still got more that are available. And it maps these proxy machines. And so these proxy machines are part of a botnet. So a botnet is basically a collection of compromised computers under the control of a botnet master. And these computers are regular PCs running Windows normally that just happen to have some vulnerability that got exploited. And the people who are participating in this botnet have no idea. It's done. You have some idle processors running in the background, and you turn on your computer. It might be running a little slower than you expect, but it's otherwise completely undetectable. Meanwhile, you could be participating and hosting a phishing web page. Your PC in your dorm room could be doing this. You've got a high speed connection, which is something that they like. There's really no way to tell. As an aside, talk about botnets. Does anyone know how spam is sent? You get all the spam out there. Spam. 90% of the email is spam. But how does that spam arrive at your inbox? So it used to be that there were some guys sitting in Florida in a trailer park who had a number of servers, and these computer servers would just send out millions and millions of spam emails. Up until about 5 years ago, this is how it was done. But what happened instead is we had the passage of the Canned Spam Act, which made spam definitely illegal, even though it already was illegal. And then you also had the adoption of these blacklists, where the spam companies realized, there's 50 million emails a day coming out of this one computer in Florida. Maybe we should block it. So they did that. So the attackers then moved on to sending spam through botnets. So you're running Windows and you get exploited, you could very well be sending spam, literally tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of spams per hour, even while we're sitting in this classroom, and you wouldn't know the difference. So they moved to this botnet infrastructure because it's much harder to control. You've got hundreds of thousands of machines which are all participating in it. You've all heard of Conficker? Yeah, everyone was all scared because on April 1st something bad was going to happen. But we didn't know what. Well, Conficker is a very large botnet. It has around 4 million computers in it, I think, by the latest count. If we look, what this graph shows you is going back to these Rockfish attackers. Remember, they're registering all these domains. They've got all these computers in a botnet. And when you look at how many domains and machines they have active on a given day, it's always greater than zero. They may have somewhere between 10, 20, up to 70 domains which are operational. So even though the companies which are trying to remove these domains, they may pat themselves on the back because they're removing 10 a day or 15 a day or whatever, when you link them all together as this one Rockfish gang, they're doing just fine. They're prepared for any kind of. They're prepared for the response that's coming. Similarly, when you look here, this is the number of machines that get added or removed in a given day, and it's very tightly correlated. You know, so the red shows how many are added on a given day, and the blue shows how many are removed. So, you know, you remove 10 IP addresses, they add 15. You remove two, they add two. So it's a well-oiled machine here, so to ensure that they constantly have these scams running. So let me get to the lifetime. So we measured how long it takes to remove phishing websites. And it turns out they actually do a pretty good job. All in all, it takes somewhere between 2 and 3 days on average to remove a phishing site. When you break it down, if the bank actually knows about the phishing site, they remove it very, very quickly. We see somewhere like 3 or 4 hours from the time they learn about it to the time it's removed. Now, where they do a little bit worse is when they don't know about it. Often, if they only become aware of this phishing site, 3 days after the fact that one of their competitors already knew about it, it takes them naturally far longer to get the content removed. But it's still pretty good, especially when we start to compare it to other types of badness. Right, so one final thing I'll say here. These phishing gangs will target one particular domain at a time. And they'll go after one they've never targeted before. And there are lots of these domain name registrars, which are companies which register web domains. There are literally thousands of them, and they just pick one at a time who they haven't gone after before, and they're quite successful. So if you look here, this is from March to August of 2007. This is for the .hk domain. So this one phishing gang decided they were going to target Hong Kong addresses, and they registered a whole bunch. And if you look at first, so the y-axis shows the lifetime of the site based on the day it's reported, right? So at first, sites last for a month. They're the very first sites that they targeted. And then eventually, after about a month, in April, the Hong Kong authorities figured out what was going on. They figured out the scam, and they started to remove the domains more quickly. But as soon as that happened, by May, the gang had already moved on to .cn addresses. And so you just have this shifting from one authority to the next. So you're going from, and as soon as one authority gains some clue and figures out what the attacks are, the attackers just move on to the next thing. And this is sort of the downside of a global internet, is that you have lots of different jurisdictions, lots of different authorities, and the attackers can systematically exploit the lack of knowledge from one jurisdiction to the next. So, all right, so let's talk about some other kinds of bad content besides phishing. So you may wonder, how do the phishers even make money, right? So they steal the credentials. You log into a fake Bank of America site, they have your online banking account information, but then what do? Well, they could sell it, and there's some evidence that sometimes they sell it. Or they may directly try to steal the money out of the account. And the way they do that is that they're careful. They're not just going to log in from Russia or Romania or wherever they're located and initiate the transfer to their bank account. Instead, they launder the money through money mules. So mules are like drug mules, people who carry contraband on behalf of others. Well, mules are also used to launder money, and this is how phishing is monetized. So in order to do this, in addition to running phishing websites, the same phishing gangs will create fake companies with very extensive websites, claiming that they're hiring, and effectively they just are hiring money mules. So if you look, this is Waller Truck Company. They're a first-rate premium quality carrier. There's all sorts of things here. You learn about the company, its drivers, but you'll see that they're hiring. They're hiring a regional sales manager, okay? And the key thing a regional sales manager needs to do is manage as part of a sales cycle, ensure fast remittance of payments through your bank account, and then through worldwide Western Union system and calculate fees at each step. Okay, does anyone see what's going on here? Okay, so these people think they're going to work for Waller Truck Company, but in fact, they are given the details of a fished Bank of America customer, some other bank customer, which they then basically hook up their payment between Bank of America and them and the mule, who thinks he's a regional sales manager, and the regional sales manager takes a 10% cut of the $10,000 or whatever, and then he sends it off by Western Union to the Ukraine or whatever country they've been told to do. Okay? So it's sort of a thinly veiled scheme here where people can sort of think it's legitimate, work from home, make good money, right? It's a trying economy. But in the end, what happens, the key thing is that this is a Western Union transaction. And, you know, whenever you're dealing with a bank transfer within a country, banks have reciprocal agreements where if the transaction turns out to be fraudulent, the banks will sort of send the money back. With Western Union, there is no guarantee. It's what's called a non-revocable transaction. Once it's out the door through Western Union, there's no getting it back by law. And so this is what's being exploited. And so the mule thinks that they're getting this great 10% cut. All they had to do is transfer some money. But what happens is, you know, a few weeks later, when the bank figures out what the scam is, they come back to the mule and transfer all the money back to the originating fished victim's account, and the mule gets out all of the money. Yes, they offer a base salary with generous commissions, 10% out of each payment you've dealt with. So these guys just go from, they create one company to the next because they create the company, they advertise it through spam. You may see some spam emails that get through your filters, which are offering you a generous, great working opportunity. So they were on Waller Truck for a couple of months. When that got sussed out, they ended up moving on to this Harvey Investment Company, right? So, and it turns out there is a real Harvey Investment Company. They're not very good at English, so they just sometimes will steal legitimate websites. And so the real Harvey Investment Company, they were kind of bothered by this because they ended up getting all these phone calls from people trying to get jobs, right? Saying, I'm applying for the regional sales manager job, please. And they say, no, go away, we're not hiring. So this is a nuisance to them, but they're not going to go after it the same way that banks is going to go after it, right? So they aren't going to put money and resources in removing the fake Harvey Investment websites. So all they did instead, their due diligence was, this is on their real website, putting an advisory at the bottom of the page saying they've been advised of websites that have been created to look like our website. Which include links to apply for a position to the company. These websites are fakes. Please don't respond. But that's the end of it. So the banks aren't going to end up don't end up doing anything about it either. So the banks throw lots of resources at removing phishing websites that impersonate them directly, but they don't put any resources at all into removing the Harvey Investment Company and Waller Trucks of this world. Because their brand isn't being directly impersonated, even though this is a very essential wheel in the whole phishing scheme, right? So when you look at the lifetimes here, you'll see the average lifetime for one of these sites is about 300 hours, so a dozen, 12 days or so, 2 weeks. And when you look at this period over the course of a year, they just went from one scheming fake company to the next. Started with Lux Capital, then Aegis Capital, Sydney Carson. They just went from one to the next as people figured out what was going on. But you might wonder why these things are being removed at all. I said the banks don't care, even though they should. The only people who care are these online volunteers like Fish Tank. So Fish Tank is a volunteer organization focusing on phishing websites. There's a whole other one, some other website called AA419, which goes after these new recruitment websites. So these are volunteers. They're not getting paid for their time, but they still do a pretty good job. They don't do as good a job as the phishing, because the banks are putting more resources into it, but still a valiant effort. Okay, so online pharmacies. So there are real online pharmacies, and then there's Canadian Pharmacy. So this is a pharmacy which you might get advertised in your spam for Viagra or whatever. You click on the link and it takes you here. It turns out that these pharmacies are hosted on the same infrastructure that some of these phishing websites are hosted on. You remember I was talking about the botnets, which relay the phishing pages back to a server. Well, the same thing happens for the online pharmacies. So you've got the exact same technical infrastructure. However, the pharmaceutical companies don't care, and they make no effort to remove sites. And there is no equivalent of a volunteer group, equivalent of a fish tank, to remove the sites. So they just stay up forever. So we had an average lifetime of a few months. And there, it's unclear why they ever even disappeared at all. So I think the point I want to make here is, people may say to you that, we have this, the attackers are so sophisticated technically, there's nothing we can do to stop them. Well, that's not true, at least in this case, because using the exact same technology, phishing websites are removed within, 2 days, not 3 months. So what really seems to matter is whether or not the person who's trying to remove the site has a strong incentive to remove the site. So because as we see, law enforcement's not going to do anything about any of these. So what you have to do, well, you have to rely on private actors and what their interests are. Right. So I skipped some stuff. All right. So I'll conclude with talking about child sexual abuse images, so child pornography websites. So this is probably the most widely condemned form of online content. It's pretty much universally illegal. It's certainly more clearly illegal than a lot of the other content we've looked at. So we managed to get in touch with the Internet Watch Foundation, which is sort of a British organization which tracks and tries to remove these child pornography websites. They have a trained staff which check reports, pass along to the police if they determine it's illegal. If the site's located in Britain, they'll communicate with the ISP directly. But crucially, if the site's not located in Britain, they will try to liaise with the equivalent police force in the country where the site is actually hosted. So as you can see, this is different from how things are done for removing phishing websites and all these other types of content. The banks don't care where the site's located. If it's in China, they'll call their contacts in China. You can't do that with child pornography because it's illegal, and just the possession of it could get you thrown in jail for a long time, as Professor Lewis has talked about off and on through the course. This group, they gave us sanitized data because we couldn't check the sites ourselves. And what we found is that the lifetimes for these sites was actually very long, much longer than phishing, much longer than mule recruitment websites. The only thing that was shorter than was the online pharmacies, which nobody seemed to remove. And this is a little surprising. But when you dig a bit deeper, you can see the explanation, and let me skip to the explanation here. So, as I've been repeating a couple of times already, the incentive for removal is what matters most. And for child sexual abuse images, the responsibility for takedown has been split up legally. It's not like with phishing, where it's a global internet, it's a global response. Here, it's divided along national lines, and by having to pass information from one police force to the next, significant delays can get introduced. For example, Sites hosted in Britain, according to the Internet Watch Foundation, are removed very quickly, within a day. If it's not in the UK, all they do is they pass it along to the law enforcement. So sometimes the people in the corresponding countries will remove the content very quickly. Other times they don't. And a lot of the long-lived websites are actually located in the US. It's not a matter of these sites being in untouchable countries that where we can't apply political pressure. A lot of the longest lived sites are here in the US. And part of the problem I'm trying to communicate to you is that it's that the IAWF and these organizations don't have the authority to issue the takedown notices to ISPs as they would for the other types of bad content. So it's just a different way of thinking. It's true that because the content is so illegal and the possession of it could land you serious jail time, you can't be quite as free in sharing the information. You couldn't have an equivalent of fish tank for child pornography websites, obviously. It's definitely a bit trickier, but the main point I'm going to communicate to you is that legal frameworks aren't a panacea. It's not a matter of saying, if only we could, you know, have a great legal structure for dealing with internet crime, everything will be fine. What matters is the people who want to remove the content actually take the action. Right. So I think I'm about done. So just quick conclusions. There's a lot of illegal material online besides copyright violations and slander, what we've been talking about so far in the course. And you have big differences in the speed of removing content, which I would say is explained by the incentives for removing the content. Banks focusing on phishing narrowly means that they overlook new recruitment websites, and dividing up responsibility for removing child pornography websites according to national basis significantly slows the removal. So I think I'm done. If anyone has any questions or comments, you can do that now. So what do you think? Go ahead.
With the child pornography, the law, law enforcement still isn't really, or what's the extent of law enforcement involvement in child pornography?
So it's very significant. It is of all the stuff I presented to you today, they are most involved with child pornography, and they do a good job for the sites that they know about, and we see this as well with phishing and other kinds of content. If they know about a site, they're very good at removing it. But what we had, for instance, was a data source from outside the U.S., which had a view on a lot of American sites that somehow didn't get passed through the right channels to actually get the content removed. So I think, on the whole, they're doing a very good job in dealing with child pornography. I think they could do better still. All right. Okay. Thanks.